from West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for the legislature today is provided by the following.
The West Virginia Higher Education Policy Commission, working with students and families to improve college access and student success for a better West Virginia.
Good evening. I'm Andrea Lanham for the legislature today. After multiple community meetings and plowing through the data, West Virginia Commissioner for the Bureau of Public Health is completing a statewide response plan. Dr. Raul Gupta will join us in just a few minutes. But first, the legislature approved a resolution today to authorize a monument on the Capitol grounds dedicated to the sacrifice of Gold Star families, families of fallen soldiers. The project was led by Medal of Honor recipient and World War II hero, Herschel Williams, better known by his nickname, Woody. The 94-year-old West Virginian served in the Marines and was decorated for heroism at Iwo Jima.
And it's long past time that we who have had the privilege of living our lives in a free society honor them in a way that their loved ones will not be forgotten. As I travel around over this country, breaking ground or dedicating a Gold Star Family Memorial Monument in honor of those from those communities, one of the most expressed concerns is that their loved one will be forgotten.
West Virginia leaders from the American Federation of Teachers, the West Virginia Education Association, the UMWA, the AFL-CIO, and others representing thousands of public employees gathered at the Culture Center this afternoon, speaking about low pay, rising insurance costs, and demanding that lawmakers address what they called a crisis situation.
You see, PEIA is a huge problem. To a group of employees who have not seen a pay raise of any type, PEIA continues each year to take money out of their pockets in order to balance the budget. For years, PEIA has continuously balanced the budget on the backs of the employees through premium increases, increased co-pays and deductibles, and changes to the prescription drug plan. Well, that too has to stop, and it has to stop now.
The Senate passed a bill today that creates a sexual assault victim's bill of rights. Dave Mistich details that bill in another piece of legislation under consideration that aims to help sexual assault victims.
The bill seeks to codify best practices in the wake of a sexual assault. For example, the bill would allow victims to choose someone to accompany him or her to a hospital or other healthcare facility and to attend proceedings concerning the alleged assault, including police and prosecution interviews, as well as court. Senator Mike Wolfel is a lead sponsor of Senate Bill 39. He says the purpose of the bill is to modernize the way sexual assault victims are treated.
I believe that in our state, in virtually any state, you have probably one out of three or four girls is sexually abused in her lifetime, and probably one out of seven boys. So it's a grossly underreported crime.
Senate Bill 39 passed on a 33-0 vote and now heads to the House. A companion measure, Senate Bill 36, seeks to expand DNA testing and streamlines the process of obtaining results. Senator Wolfel, who is also the lead sponsor of that legislation, outlined some of the issues that brought about the bill.
The rape kit, once it gets to the state police lab, sits there on average 440 days. So you can have frequently, if not commonly, a two-year wait, a delay between a rape and the evaluation of the evidence. Can you imagine how many sexual assault victims after 2 years have turned the page in their life? So that's unacceptable.
The Senate Health Committee is expected to take up that bill. For the legislature today, I'm Dave Mistich in the Senate.
Last session, West Virginia passed the Medical Cannabis Act, permitting patients with a written doctor's certification to use medical cannabis and buy it from registered dispensaries. The bill was a big shock, with few thinking at one time that passage was possible. But as Kara Lofton reports, supporters of the bill this session say it didn't go far enough, while opponents say it went too far.
Outside of the Capitol building, about 50 people have gathered.
You know, this is a seed that has been used for thousands of years.
That's West Virginia Senator Richard Ojeda. He was the lead sponsor on the cannabis bill. The bill that passed last year allows for the sale and consumption of pills, oils, gels, creams, and ointments, tinctures, among other things. Dispensaries cannot sell edibles, or what Ojeda will call gummies, in a few minutes. But medical cannabis products can be mixed into food or drinks by patients themselves. Vaporization is allowed, but smoking is prohibited. Patients may only obtain a 30-day supply of cannabis at a time. Ojeda says those provisions are not enough. The original bill the Senate passed was a lot more generous than the one that ultimately came out of the House. Ojeda says he wants to change that this legislative session.
When it got over to the House, they got rid of the plants, they got rid of the gummies, you know, no leaf.
The current law doesn't allow patients to grow plants themselves.
I want 8 plants, and it only can be by a person who has the medical marijuana card. So if you're growing and you don't have the card, then you're breaking the law.
Ojeda got into this fight in the first place because a few months earlier, Rusty Williams, a cancer survivor who self-medicated with cannabis during his treatment, walked into his office and asked him for help pushing through the medical marijuana bill. When Williams was diagnosed with cancer, he said his doctors told him that he would have about 4 months to live with aggressive chemotherapy. And with aggressive chemotherapy, he had about a 30% chance of beating his disease. But the chemotherapy made him nauseous, lose his appetite, and experience terrible dizziness.
The world would spin so violently I couldn't open my eyes. And within 30 seconds of one hit of cannabis, that would stop. And I was able to function, eat, I could sleep normally. But chemotherapy, I don't know that there are words to properly describe what that feels like. You feel yourself dying. You can feel your body dying. I mean, it's a brutal feeling.
William's story resonated with Ojeda.
It just hit me. I started thinking about, you know, 22 veterans are committing suicide every day. And then started, you know, thinking about some of the research that I had seen in the past in reference to, you know, people that have used medical marijuana in other areas. Where they have seen great results. And I started thinking, you know, West Virginia is a place that absolutely could benefit greatly from medical marijuana.
Williams and Ojeda mobilized, recruiting advocates to call their legislators and shut down the phones, as they put it. At the end of the session, the bill that wasn't expected to make it out of committee was signed into law. Medical marijuana is currently legal in 29 states, but is not legal according to the federal government. That discrepancy is a big problem for opponents to the medical marijuana bill, like Senator Ryan Weld.
Per the federal government, it's illegal. And we have what's called the Supremacy Clause in the United States Constitution. And that means that no state law can be in conflict with the federal law. Now, if the federal government, if Congress wants to pass a law that legalizes marijuana, I don't have a dog in the fight, and that's fine. It's up to them to do so, and they might. But at the time, and it still is, illegal.
Weld argues that by legalizing marijuana on the state level, state legislators are setting up West Virginians to be in contempt of federal law. Under President Obama, he says, that might have been okay, but the Trump administration is very different than Obama's.
If this presidency, if the Trump administration has shown one thing, it's that they're not always going to be predictable. And so I don't think anybody could say, well, they're definitely going to continue the policy of the Obama administration in adhering to what was called the Cole memo. And that was basically a DOJ memo that said we're not going to enforce federal marijuana laws and allowed for this kind of situation to flourish.
In fact, 4 days before we spoke with Weld, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions issued his own memo that said, quote, given the department's well-established general principles, previous nationwide guidance specific to marijuana enforcement is unnecessary and rescinded, effective immediately. But Ojeda has an entirely different take on the situation and is not worried about federal repercussions.
They legalize it in other states. I mean, if it was done in other states, why can't it be done here? You know, as a matter of fact, the current regime is the ones who always say we want to give states more rights. And then we finally did something and passed historic legislation to finally give us a tool that can combat the opioid epidemic.
At this point, though, no legislation has been introduced to either improve or remove the medical marijuana bill. For the Legislature Today, I'm Carol Lofton.
Senator Ojeda said today he will introduce legislation in the next few days that would broaden West Virginia's medical marijuana law. Joining me now is Dr. Raul Gupta, Commissioner of the Bureau of Public Health. Dr. Gupta, thank you so much for joining me tonight.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to get into the opioid response plan, but first I want to get a brief comment from you just discussing the medical marijuana bill. And in your mind, does it go far enough and is it an effective tool to combat our opioid crisis?
Well, when Governor Justice signed the bill into law last year, I think one of the words he said was, we have to be compassionate with people. And we certainly, as the agency responsible for ensuring the implementation of this particular law, we've tried to make sure that we do what we have to move forward with this law in a compassionate way, in a way that understands the needs of the people, needs of the state, and try to bring everybody together in order to put a lot of work together in order to stand up a complicated program ready to go in July of 2019.
So I think it's important to note with this crisis with opioids, it involves both prescribed and illicit opioids, including fentanyl and heroin. We're going to be talking about the state's newly completed plan to combat opioid. But first, we're going to set the scene with a clip from Oscar-nominated film or documentary Heroin by West Virginia filmmaker Elaine McMillian Sheldon.
Angel one responding.
I'm not really sure what a plateau is going to look like. You know, I see this as a countrywide problem that has the potential to bankrupt the country. You know, we conservatively estimated that Cabell County, and we're talking 96,000 people, spent probably about $100 million in health care costs associated with IV drug use in 2015. That's one small county and one small state. I can't even fathom what it's going to look like when it plateaus. But I know it will be welcomed.
Yes, ma'am, this was an overdose. We're clear returning.
Oh my goodness, I love it. Kelly has a business card. Is that the coolest thing ever? Kelly J. Stickler, recovery coach. But I'm so proud of you.
Thank you.
Naja, you wanna come on up? So, today's special day?
5 months clean.
5 months clean?
Yay!
When was the last time you had 5 months clean time?
3 years ago.
3 years ago. I'm really, really proud of you. You're doing wonderful things in the program.
I'm trying.
Dr. Gupta, this is something that has devastated our state.
Certainly, we know that not only is West Virginia the top state in the overdose deaths in the nation, but we lead in great percentages next to the next state in line for 2016, which is Ohio. And often what happens is we are left at just that point. What we're trying to do is get people to understand behind these overdoses is a compendium and a huge number of people who remain addicted. And then another set of people who are at risk for addiction. So we have to roll up our sleeves and start to work. And that's one of the aspects of the plan that we're actually moving forward with that has been in the recent months.
So let's go through that opioid response plan. Prevention is key, and obviously it's the first step. And we do that by being very careful about writing prescriptions.
Correct. And you know, one of the things we have done in this particular epidemic, because again, it is the worst public health disaster in the history of this nation. But we know some, but we don't know everything about this disaster. So one of the first things we did last year, we said, since we have not peaked, We want to know the characteristics of every person that has died in 2016. And we developed a so-called, what you could say, a profile of the victim. And we gained a lot of information. We gained information like 4 out of the 5 people actually had a contact with the healthcare system. 91% had a history of interacting and getting a prescription for controlled substances. In fact, 49% of the women in there had a prescription filled in the last 30 days, and 36% of the men. So there are so many important findings that were relevant to. Think about it this way. If you know you're a male with a family history, age 50, of heart disease and high cholesterol, your doctor is going to be very concerned about your health and ability, you know, the risk to get a heart attack. Just like that, we are working to develop that profile, and we certainly have one. We also then, what we did was, we brought in experts, national and regional experts from Hopkins, from West Virginia University, and from Marshall University, that put together this panel with an extreme amount of both investment in time, but also the interest of the public. So we've got a lot of hundreds and hundreds of public comments that came both online as well as public meeting. And that's how the plan came into play that we're basically looking at. So going back to that, one of the things we found was supply is still an issue, meaning that there are still too many pills out there, meaning in West Virginia, just recent reports show in 2017, we had about access of 230 million doses. That's about 130 pills per man, woman, and child in West Virginia for the year of 2017. So we want to curb that.
So next, there's early intervention with public campaigns and law enforcement. Can you go into that?
Certainly. One of the things we're finding, in addition to finding ways to curb the initial prescribing, now I want to be very clear, this is in no way, we do not want to impact the people who have chronic pain issues and are suffering from chronic pain. It's very important to understand that the prescriptions we're talking about is for initial prescribers. For, you know, the young 17-year-old who gets a ankle sprain, to make sure that that child does not become a drug addict and does not get, 30 days of supply of pain pills or after tooth extraction. This is not intended to impact negatively those people who have been on pain medication for chronic pain conditions. One of the reasons I emphasize this is because we have a stigma problem in our state, in our nation. In fact, some of the scientific research that has shown, like SAMHSA survey, has shown that majority of the people who need to get into treatment, about 80% of them do not. And when they're asked, why not? Why do you not feel the need to get treated? There's only about 38% who say that we're not ready to quit. The rest of them talk about issues like access issues. They don't think that their employer will understand. They don't know where to go and get help. So there's a significant amount of data that shows that the stigma is still a central core of why even people who want to get help do not decide to get help.
And part of early intervention, too, is something quite controversial, and that's the harm reduction policies. Can you explain those and talk about whether you've received any pushback from that in your sure. public comments?
Yeah, so one of the things we do as a sort of a, you know, science approach to this is to look for policies that work elsewhere. So I'll give you an example of Austin, Indiana, that's Scott County, Indiana, when Governor Pence was there. One of the things that happened is in a very quick amount of time, there were about over 200 cases of HIV in a very rural county that could be any county in the state of West Virginia. And as a result, there were several cases of hepatitis as well. Estimates show that not only these people end up having a lifelong fatal disease, potentially, but also it cost just the investigation of that anywhere between $60 and $200 million. And we're not even counting the amount of money to treat as well as the suffering. We want to avoid that happening in West Virginia. We're at very high risk. So a risk like that happening in somewhere in West Virginia is inevitable unless we take measures, significant measures to avoid that. These harm reduction type of methods is one such strategy to do that. The idea, nobody should be saying, let's just go and get people to exchange needles. What we should be saying is, we want to get people into treatment and recovery, and this is one way to do that. Evidence shows that when the people go to these programs, they are 5 times more likely to get into treatment, just by attending this, because there's a lot of prejudgment and stigma. People don't want to go to healthcare providers because they think they'll be judged for that. So these programs help. So, and there's obviously a pushback. Anytime there's a program like this that we're, there's a thought that maybe we are propagating the habit, or maybe it's not the best way to do it. But at the end of the day, these are some of those policies that are evidence-based, science-tested, and data-driven.
Now, Dr. Gupta, we're quickly running out of time, so I definitely want to get through the rest of this plan. Now, part of this is overdose reversal as well, and that involves first responders and reporting of non-fatal overdoses.
In our study, one of the things we found was of the people who for whom the EMS was called, only about 30% or so actually got naloxone. So we have a huge number of people that could have been saved. So there exists such an enormous opportunity there, because my feeling is you cannot treat a person if they're not alive. So the first step is actually making naloxone available. And I understand sometimes it's resource constraint for first responders to have naloxone, but it's very important to try to help these people and just not only save. That's not also fair. We have to get these people every opportunity to get into treatment. So the idea is not just to give them naloxone and let them walk away. I think we should think about developing sustainable models where people are able to then get the help, get into treatment, recovery, and back into the workforce. Because these folks who are dying are young, working, age population. So we cannot have a vibrant economy without a vibrant, drug-free workforce.
And the next part is supporting families with mom and baby programs.
We have some tremendous programs already available that actually show that if you can keep that family unit together in a traditional sense, then that child has the best chance of surviving to become not become an addict, if you think about it. We have some of the highest rates of neonatal absence syndrome in the nation. That means a baby being born dependent on drugs. It is critical that we try to find that bonding in the early phase between mom and baby. Also, in those who are not addicted even, the proximity of mother's care is very critical in so many different aspects. One of the things we're having is we're having a crisis of child welfare. And that's the reason that really Governor Justice has said that and given us the task to do everything we can do to impact this crisis. And, you know, this is one of those reasons that we want to have those policies and programs.
And the last piece, of course, is recovery. The plan believes peer-based support is the most effective.
I think in addition to high-quality treatment, having those peer recovery networks available and expanded across West Virginia. And, you know, the way to look at this is all paths lead to treatment and all paths lead to recovery. And there's no one better who understand recovery than your peers who have gone through this process. And therefore, we want to expand every single opportunity exists in those people who have recovered for them to share their experience, their knowledge, get back into workforce, but then also help one more person recover fully and get back. So this is one crisis. On one hand, it's multifaceted, touches every fabric of the community. But I can tell you, I'm optimistic, because there is a way to solve this crisis too, which is using us as people who are suffering, turning people who are addicted and dependent into peer recoveries coaches. So there is a way to solve this crisis as well, and that's the whole idea of the plan.
So what can lawmakers do this session as far as money goes to help this crisis?
Well, one of the things is that the governor has a couple of bills sponsored towards this. And that includes both addressing the supply side in terms of for initial prescribers to limiting prescriptions, allowing more thoughtful prescribing and those kind of approaches without hurting the people who chronically use pain for pain conditions. The other, of course, is to expand treatment. You know, if there are unnecessary restrictions that cause the lack of expansion of the what we call MAT or medication-assisted treatment, we need to do that. Treatment is critical. Recovery is critical. So those bills, and allow demonstration projects to occur in communities, because it's communities where folks are going through this, but also who have the answers. One of the things in our report was we asked the communities and people to provide a solution, and that has made a very critical impact and helped build that report.
Well, Dr. Gupta, can you share your final thoughts on this really quickly? We're almost out of time.
Certainly. I think there's a lot of optimism in the way we may be having a high overdose rate in the nation, but I think if we do it right, we follow the plan, I have every expectation that we will actually come out of this and we will do a good job. I remain optimistic because of the ability for all West Virginians to come together and be led by our state, our governor, and I think we are at a precipice of success.
Dr. Raul Gupta, Commissioner of the Bureau for Public Health, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for tonight's program. Tomorrow night, a look at Senate Bill 270, allowing logging in state parks. The bill has some very angry opponents and has pitted two Justice Administration department heads against each other on the issue. We'll hear from the Director of the Division of Forestry and the West Virginia Commissioner of Agriculture tomorrow evening on the Legislature Today. I'm Andrea Lanham for West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Thanks for watching and have a good evening. Mm-hmm.